So, recap of what we were talking about 2 weeks ago, which was that Kay and I had gone to a retreat that Zachoje Rinpoche had been giving. And as is often the case with his retreats, the experience I had was to start seeing things in a different way that I'd seen in kind of a certain habitual way for many years. I mean, in a habitual way in regards to Buddhist practice or thought. And the thing that struck me was a different way to think about the five aggregates, and so that's what I talked about last week. But let me do a recap to sort of bring everybody onto the same page, if you will. And what that is that when the Buddha began teaching, he did so in a very practical kind of way. I mean, when people would ask him questions about things that he considered very metaphysical, he would not answer them. And basically what he would say is, let's talk about what's important to you and what's really of concern to you. And it's not, did God create the universe or something like that? You know, what was there before the beginning of time, or what is there at the end of time, or any of the, you know, stuff that our minds can go to. But rather, how do you have a happy and fulfilling life, to use the modern language? It's not quite the way the Buddha would say it, but it's best to use modern language. And being a very practical teacher, he focused on what was there for people to experience. He didn't focus on some metaphysical ideas, but he started with what was at hand and asked people basically to examine their experience as a way of understanding what it was that they were not wanting in life, and how to find what it was that they were wanting in life. Or as the Dalai Lama said in a talk that we've been liking, that he did during the during his visit to Washington, D.C. in the beginning of the summer, people don't really seem to know the means for finding their own happiness. They seem to be chasing after happiness, but unsuccessfully. And if you really kind of look at what that means, what he said is, what it means is probably that the means that people are using to achieve happiness are not successful means, or else they'd be achieving happiness. But they're not, because if you put 100 people in a room and ask those 100 people how many are happy, you know, 95% of the time, how many hands would go up? Not very many, probably. But the Buddhist view is there's no particular reason why you couldn't be happy all the time. You just have to figure out what it is that's keeping you from being happy, and then stop doing what makes you not happy and start doing what makes you happy, which would sound like a simple thing, except we don't really know. We don't really know what we're doing that makes us unhappy, and we don't know what to do to make ourselves happy, obviously, because we're not making ourselves happy, which doesn't seem actually all that obvious, I guess, to most people, because they keep doing the same thing over and over again and not getting happy. I'm not saying that I'm an exception. I'm just, it's kind of the human condition. So therein lies the problem. So what the Buddha taught, for starters, was to begin looking at what is our experience, and then maybe we can figure out what it is about our experience that's not working for us and make some changes to it. So the place that he started was to be non-metaphysical and said, what do we know about our experience? Well, one thing we know about our experience is that we have a body. Pretty much everyone would agree that we have a body. And he went on from there and he said, now let's look at our experience and see if we can sort of organize it into some categories of similarity and difference. And in doing so, that might help us understand what our experience is and how the different elements of our experience relate to each other. He says, okay, so for starters, we can all agree that we have a body, and that one thing that's really different than our body is that in our experience, we find that there are things that we like and things that we don't like and things we're kind of neutral about. We don't care one way or the other about those things. And that that experience of being attracted to things or repulsed by things is really very different than the thing itself that we're attracted to or repulsed by or that we don't care about. So we can right off the bat say, now here's two elements to our experience that are very different to each other. They relate to each other, but being attracted to something and the fact that the thing itself exists as a material thing, those are two different things entirely. But we can, everyone can agree, unless you're an anthropologist, because my brother argued with me about this one, that all human, he's an anthropologist, that all human beings are either attracted to things, repelled by things, or are neutral about them, and that there are no other kinds of feelings but those three feelings in that sense. I mean, there are feelings like love and hate, so on and so forth. But even in those cases, when you boil those things down, there's an attraction or a repulsion that's going on. And that's very different than the thing itself. And then the Buddha went on to say, well, now if you look at that, the other thing that you'll recognize is that experience is a matter of perception, that you experience things, you see things, or you hear things, or you smell things, or you touch things, or you taste things. And that your senses provide very different kinds of experience of things that you could either be attracted to or repelled by, but that there's a perceptual process going on. And that a perceptual process is different than attraction-repulsion, and the perceptual process is also different than the thing perceived. For example, I can be looking at a tree, and there it is, but if I close my eyes, I can't see it. The tree hasn't gone away. I mean, most of us would agree upon that. Not everybody, of course, but most people would agree that that's the case. And that's an indication of the fact that perception is going on, that there's something there that we can be attracted to, but there's a perceptual process that's going on. And that in the perceptual process, it's also the case that we're aware of what's happening, that perception involves awareness, that it's not simply the case that I open and close my eyes and the tree is there and not there. It's not that the tree is sort of ontologically there and not there. It's that when I close my eyes, I'm no longer aware of the tree being there. When I open my eyes, I'm aware of the tree being there. So the perceptual process involves a sense organ, involves objects, and involves awareness. So that's a different category, if you will. Perception is different than attraction or repulsion. And perception is different than physical objects. And perception is also different than just the awareness, although awareness is involved in perception. Perception and awareness are two different things, or consciousness and perception are two different things. Because you can have consciousness of things seen, consciousness of things heard, consciousness of things that you taste. What they have in common is consciousness, but these are all still different perceptions. So he made these into different categories for the purpose of analysis and recognizing the character of experience. And then finally, there's a category of things that are not easily pointed to that might, in our modern language, be called habits. Because we have these tendencies to do things in certain repeating patterns. We have the tendencies to like certain things other people dislike. We have the tendency to perceive in certain kinds of ways that other people don't necessarily perceive in that particular way. So these kind of habit patterns, which come out of our childhood or previous lives, if you like that, or social conditioning. That's another kind of thing, because habit is different than perception. Habit is different than awareness, and so on and so forth. So that division into five categories, which in the Buddha's time were called the five aggregates, was then fundamental to his teaching. And The reason it was fundamental is it becomes the starting point for looking at experience and trying to disentangle what it is about experience that is working positively for one or not working positively for one. In other words, what is it about the way experience is happening that makes you happy, or what is it about it, experience that makes you unhappy? And if you can't see how you experience things, then there's no possibility of changing that process so that there's less unhappiness and more happiness, so that you can stop doing, thinking, and saying things that make you unhappy, and start doing, thinking, and saying things, or what have you, that make you happy. So you've got to understand how the internal process works. And so this is the point of departure for that. Then the question would always come up, there's something missing here, isn't there, which is I, because that seems to be the monkey wrench in all of this, if you will, or something like that. That we feel like there's a person who's having all these experiences. And the Buddha didn't deny that. Excuse me. He didn't deny that we feel like there's a person having these experiences. But he said, okay, what is that? Where is that? Is that something that's different than these five categories? If it's something that's in the five categories, what is it? And so having this way of talking about things, this language in the five categories, or skandhas in Sanskrit, or aggregates, that's the way it's usually translated, was really then a way of getting at, you know, what am I that's having these experiences? What am I that's happy or unhappy or something like that? And so the Buddha invited people to investigate that, and usually the way the investigation went was pretty analytic, and it'd be kind of like, okay, am I the same as my body or not? And, you know, am I the same as my perceptions or not? Am I the same as my feelings or not? And mostly the way people would follow that kind of analytic approach, if you get at it in detail, it's sort of like, well, no, I'm not my body, but without my body, I'm still not me. But that's not all of me. Okay, so then I and body are not equal. And most people would say that. Most people would then say that's true. I and body are not the same thing. I mean, there's certainly a lot of people who would say I and body are the same thing. But if you pursue the analysis, even with those people, they would say, no, that's probably not true, because am I my feelings, which is different than my body? Well, no, but I'm not just my feelings, but my feelings are part of me, but that's not all of me, and I'm in them, but that's not enough. You know, and you can go through all the five skandhas, and basically the same thing happens. And so the conclusion, without belaboring this, because I'm trying to do catch-up here, the conclusion, without belaboring this, is what the Buddhist teaching was, and what the Buddha taught in the oldest teachings that have been recorded, is that somehow I am not the same as these five categories. I'm in them, but I'm not in them. I'm part of them. They're part of me. They don't describe me entirely. I'm not inside of them. I'm not outside of them. So on. So where am I? You know, that's what the Buddhist analysis is. Is I is a thought. I mean, when you look at it, I is a thought which is designated or applied to or labeled on this whole complex, and that's it. And so that's the personality. And in that sense, I is a habit, or it's a thought, or it's a repeating pattern. And that's kind of all it is. And I went on at some length about this 2 weeks ago, so not now, but if you're really curious, you can listen to the recording 2 weeks ago. Anyway, the big thing that Zha Choje's teaching, sort of the big impact his teaching had on me, was, as he pointed out, that even in doing all of this analysis, there's something, all these categories are contained within something, which is to say, you can't exactly say that they're contained within what exists. I mean, you could sort of say that they are contained with what exists, because they do exist. But that's kind of an idea rather than a fact, right? And you can say, well, they sort of then exist how? And what Zatsuji was saying was that there's kind of a space in which our experience is occurring, that even if we're aware, there's something that is noticing that awareness. And somehow I had never been quite cognizant, adequately cognizant of that. I mean, one of the conclusions that many people come to when they do this kind of analytic meditation is that, oh, obviously, the essence of what I really am is my consciousness. You know, it's like if there's anything that I really would be strongly feeling was me in all of this, it would be my awareness, it would be my consciousness. Although, you know, that's a little bit problematic in some ways, like when I'm sound asleep, what's going on, these kinds of things. But as he pointed out, it's like, but consciousness occurs within a space. You know, it's like I'm, it's not so much that I am conscious, but I'm aware of I, but I'm also aware of being aware. And that kind of, and my words are going to fail me tonight, I can see that, but that kind of existential space, which he called the sky-like mind, which Buddhists call the sky-like mind, which is everything, all of the elements that are I, and or me, or the person, exist within that larger everything about which you can't say anything without getting mucked up in your language, which is what's happening to me at the moment. And that was a big wake-up for me, because what I had realized was I'd kind of fallen into this place of thinking, oh, I am my consciousness, which is very limited, or not so much I am my consciousness, that the essence or my true nature is my consciousness. And that I'd fallen into that, and that was very limiting. And in the meditation practice that Zatsuji was teaching us at that time, it became clear that sort of settling oneself in one's own consciousness is not the end, but it's actually an opening into something that's much larger, and that I'd spent the last 30 years or so, like, you know, in this little tight little space instead of being as open as could be possible. And as I said, so that was sort of a big wake up. And the other thing that came out of that perspective or that way of understanding things was getting a different take on kind of the issue of compassion. And I mean, that's sort of the theme that we want to turn to this year, because we were kind of asked to do that. But that sort of spaciousness or that sky-like mind is no different for me than for anybody else. I mean, that space in which I exist, I mean, my true nature, if you will, or my true whatever, that space is the same space that everybody's in and everything is in. And it's the place, in a sense, where we all intimately connect, because there's some way in which that essential true nature of ourselves is everybody's. I mean, I don't even know how to say this. It's kind of like the Tibetans talk about it being of one taste, right? It's sort of like it tastes the same to you as it does to me, even though in a way you and I are different, but there's still one taste to it, which is kind of an interesting mixing of metaphors, like the sky has one taste for everybody. But somehow it works. I don't know. Anyhow, it works for me, and I think I'm running out of cogent language to express it. So just maybe just the way it is tonight. I'm seeing like these questioning looks, and I don't know if that's because I'm failing in communicating what I'm trying to communicate, or kind of what's happening. Well, okay. So, I mean, that's actually all I have to say at the moment. And if you have questions, we could do that.
Could you tell me the five aggregates again?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and there's kind of an interesting way to remember them. The form, which is the physical stuff, and then their feelings, which is how we were attracted to or repelled by form. We're attracted to things or repelled by them, we're neutral about them, so that's the second one. Third one is perception, or let's see, what did Satchoji call it? He didn't call it perception. He called it thought, because thoughts are always wrapped up in perceptions. But anyhow, I like to call it perception, which includes thought. And then the fourth one would be habits, or the leftovers of previous experience.
Which is different than thought, because...
Which is different than thought. And I'll explain why. And then the fifth one is awareness or consciousness.
Is perception the sense, our senses?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but perception happens through the six senses. That's the tricky thing in Buddhism, that the sixth sense is the mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They view mind as an organ which is aware of thoughts and other perceptions. So it's like an integrator. Mm-hmm. It kind of integrates all the thoughts. Yeah. So the way habit and perception and awareness work together is that we don't just see what's there, we don't just hear what's there. All of our perceptions and what we're aware of is shaped by language, culture, and this sort of thing. I mean, that's not new news to any of us. We're all pretty educated people. And sort of the place where the impact of education and cultural learning and so on and so forth resides is in the habits, if you will. So the habits actually shape the way we perceive. The way I look at a pickup truck and the way other people in this town look at a pickup truck are probably not the same. And there are probably a lot of reasons for that. Even though I drive basically a pickup truck, it's an SUV, and not a whole lot of difference. The back is covered, it's got a truck frame, you know, there's not a fundamental difference when you get down to it. But, you know... What?
Does it have a gun rack?
No. It doesn't have... No, it does not have a... Well, and there's no dog in the back of it either, right? So, But maybe that's not the best example in the world, but... Here's a different example. When I see deer walking down the street, probably the reaction that I have to deer walking down the street, especially this time of year, is not quite the same as a lot of other people have deer walking down the street, because I'm just not part of hunting culture. Mm-hmm. So I just view deer differently. Yeah, they do that. That's true. But we're kind of used to it. You know, we've made peace with the deer. Mm-hmm. They come and they munch and. You know, so anymore it's kind of like the stuff that they've been munching on pretty consistently isn't growing very much anymore, so it's not really too much of a problem. Yeah, so we've kind of made peace with them. We like having deer around, even with deer droppings and whatnot. So yeah, I mean, that's just cultural conditioning. It's not a matter of saying good, bad, or indifferent. It's just, you know, it's just sort of like that. Or, you know, there's certain Sundays of the year when a lot of folks are kind of glued to their television set watching football, and that would be about the last thing in the world I would be doing on a Sunday is watching football. That's, you know, it's the same kind of thing. So I was thinking there was a lot more actually I wanted to say about this, and when I was sort of imagining the talk that I would do tonight, this afternoon, there were a number of other things I wanted to say, but I think maybe I'll save them for another time, that this is kind of enough. But because what we're trying to do here is lay the ground for understanding more about compassion and developing more of a compassionate relationship with others, let me say that when Buddhists talk about compassion, they talk about relative and ultimate compassion. And the distinction there is compassion that's based on cultivating sort of both intellectually or sentimentally one's relationship with others is relative compassion. Now, that's probably not the best translation for it, but there's kind of a compassion or an altruism which is sort of based on experiencing one's relationship with others and one's dependence on others and others' dependence on oneself, and having a strong sense of we're all in this together, that we depend on each other, that we have obligations to each other, that we care about each other. And as a result of all of that, we really express that relationship in a caring, concerned sort of way, that we do fulfill each other's needs, and we do make effort to be kind to each other because we understand these things and because we have deep sentimental connections and we have an intellectual understanding of this. That's what we could call relative compassion. But ultimate compassion is when you deeply experience this sky-like mind and you recognize that we're all of one taste together in that place, then compassion and concern for one another naturally emerges out of that. That it's not really a matter of practice or intellectual understanding or cultivation or sentiment or anything else. Yeah. It's just a kind of non-conceptual, no words for it, beingness together. Which is actually, you know, I wish I could remember now the dictionary definition of compassion, but it kind of gets at that idea of oneness together in the Latin, but I can't quite get my memory banks to unlock the the safe to that particular etymology. But I know it's in there if you'd care to look for it. So there is a difference between these things. And what we'll be doing as time goes on, and starting the next time we meet, is we'll be doing some specific practices for cultivating compassion. But and those things are important, but in the end, where the fullest, deepest compassion comes from is that inner realization of one's true nature. And in that, seeing how one's true nature is no different than anybody else's true nature. And that's the ultimate source of real compassion. Because when you're in that place, then I guess you must be sort of like St. Francis or something like that. You know, he hung out with the deer and talked with them. And, you know, they weren't afraid of him. And he wasn't afraid of anything, and nothing was afraid of him, apparently, according to the stories. So I think he was at that place, is sort of my take on it. All right, that's enough rambling for the evening. We turn this thing off.